Listeners are advised such glory in this episode is a voice actor and not a real judge. This is not a real court and none of those mentioned are on trial. The scope and purpose of this episode is to create a more immersive listening experience through the events retold from the newspaper archives.
AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to AIDS the Lost Voices with me, William Hampson, and my co-host, Judge Gloria.
Mr. Hampson, please approach the bench.
Is it relevant to the matter at hand?
Did the accused put forward
in this
defense?
Series, we re-examine HIV and AIDS-related crimes from the newspaper archives of the 80s, 90s and noughties.
Court rise!
Please be seated. Mr. Hampson, please step up to the podcast microphone. It is my understanding we are here today to hear various accounts from the newspaper archives relating to the HIV/AIDS pandemic.
That's right, my lord. I've been sifting through the newspaper archives looking for HIV and AIDS-related crime stories from the 80s, 90s and noughties.
My word, you have been busy.
Yes, my lord.
Mr. Hampson, please approach the bench.
Yes, my lord. Get this. Judge Gloria said I'm serving Sue Pollard from You Rang, My Lord.
Do you like crumpet, my lord?
And I have to try and be more butch. I'll try my best.
Mr. Hampson, I see from the file before me a newspaper article that you intend to rely on in your presentation of this case today.
That's right, my lord. Casually winks to microphone. The Evening Standard was one of the first to report this incident on the 23rd of November 1989, where they ran the headline, Doctor Sold AIDS Cure. And within that article, my lord, they state, a doctor cheated dying AIDS patients out of thousands of pounds by claiming he could give them, quote, indefinite survival, the General Medical Council heard today. Dr. James Sharp was said to have boasted of a 5 out of 6 survival rate for his immunotherapy cure, normally used on acute leukemia victims. But 3 of his patients allegedly died, even after immunology expert Dr. Anthony Pinching warned him he was putting patients at risk. One dying AIDS sufferer was said to have tried to remortgage his house to pay for courses. Another young female patient allegedly received £2,500 from an AIDS charity to take the treatment. It was claimed the woman's mother paid an extra £4,500 to Dr. Sharp's Browning's Clinic in Wimpole Street, which he ran with his wife, and to the London Bridge Hospital where the treatment was given. The court heard Dr. Sharp of Camberwell hired 3 rooms at the hospital after saying he was working on an AIDS cure. It was stated that the young woman, known as Miss A, died after collapsing with anemia in November last year, and that another 2 patients, known as B and C, also died in the 2 previous months. The hearing was told how another patient called Mr. Y went to Dr. Sharp on the recommendation of patients A and B, who he both knew, and received a bill for hundreds of pounds, even though he had not said he would take the treatment. General Medical Council Councillor Mr. Timothy Langdale said, quote, unfounded and extravagant claims were made for the success of the treatment, end quote. Another patient called A said the doctor had told her, quote, the treatment will make you live indefinitely with a yearly top-up, end quote. Mr. Langdale said a BBC reporter had gone with an actor to see Dr. Sharp. The actor pretended to have AIDS and Dr. Sharp allegedly told him, quote, I don't want to bullshit you in any way, but if we get control of the disease, we are looking at indefinite survival, end quote. He faces charges of serious professional misconduct, of controlling a financial interest in a company in which he engaged practice, and consulting AIDS patients despite having insufficient knowledge, training, and expertise. He is accused of failing to disclose his financial interest in the clinic and not conducting proper clinical trials of the therapy. He is also accused of producing a misleading brochure and treating patients without seeking approval from a scientific body. The hearing continues. And by the next day, my lord, many of the national and local newspapers now had an interest in reporting on this story as the hearing continued. One of the national tabloids, the Daily Mirror, ran the headline, Bogus AIDS Cure Doc Conned Patients. And the Daily Post ran the headline, Doctor Duped AIDS Sufferers, GMC Told. And the national newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, ran the headline, AIDS Cure Misconduct Denied, where they state in their article, Dr. Sharp of Camberwell, South East London, denied serious professional misconduct. Mr. Timothy Langdale, counsel for the GMC, General Medical Council, said it was alleged Dr. Sharp held himself as providing a treatment that might be effective or would be effective when there were not sufficient grounds for such supposition. And the Daily Telegraph go on to quote Mr. Langdale as stating, "It is also part of the allegation that he secured payment through an organisation which was controlled by him in effect and in which he had a financial interest for a treatment that was, at best, wholly experimental. Dr. Sharp and his wife were controlling shareholders of a company called Dr. Browning's Clinical Pathology Service from late 1986 until February the 14th this year, 1989, he added. Mr. Langdale said that Mr. Duncan Campbell, an investigative journalist, began an investigation into Dr. Sharp. Mr. Campbell was in contact with the BBC programme Watchdog, and it was agreed someone should be sent to Dr. Sharp posing as a patient. Mr. Henry Cassidy, a male nurse, went along and Mr. Campbell went with him, also using a false name and acting as a friend and potential donor. Mr. Langdale said it was claimed Dr. Sharp never examined Mr. Cassidy nor took any notes and told Mr. Cassidy he had successful responses from 5 of the 6 patients he had treated. Later, when Mr. Campbell disclosed his identity, Dr. Sharp told him that if he and the BBC published criticism, they would compromise an innovative treatment and harm AIDS sufferers. And, my lord, in April 1989, investigative journalist Duncan Campbell wrote a 6-page article in The New Statesman where it states, in an exclusive report prepared with the BBC Watchdog programme, Duncan Campbell reveals how dying patients in one of London's largest private hospitals were experimented on by an unscrupulous clinic set up for profit from their diseases. And I should just point out that those named as living or dying from an HIV/AIDS diagnosis have been given pseudonyms, have been given alias names to protect their identities. One of the first women in Britain to be diagnosed with AIDS, Suze's immense courage and endurance in the face of a terrifying illness won the hearts of millions of people when, in 1986, she faced and overcame the stigma of AIDS. Susie first made a TV appeal for the AIDS drug AZT urgently to be brought to Britain. Later, she was filmed talking to and mixing with teenagers to show them that AIDS could be faced and fought with courage and pride. But even Susie could not fight the AIDS virus forever. After 2 years with AIDS, Susie succumbed and died last November, 1988. Age 25. Now, Susie's parents are penurious through having paid thousands of pounds to a clinic run by Dr. James Sharp and his employee, Abdul Jabbar Sultan, the vet who until last week was running London Bridge Hospital's adoptive immunotherapy unit. But the immunotherapy treatment was cruelly worthless. Sharp's form of immunotherapy wasn't and isn't a recognised or established treatment anywhere in the world. Nor was it a reasonable last-ditch attempt to save someone facing terminal illness. Dr. Sharp had never formally treated an AIDS patient before he started his money-making experiments. Worse, he and Sultan had repeatedly been warned by senior doctors not to experiment on human beings until they had shown, if they could, that the experiments might do more good than harm to seriously ill patients. But Sharp and Sultan ignored these warnings. Quote, "It's not my problem," said Sultan, whose only qualification is to practice veterinary medicine in Iraq. He couldn't wait to get his hands on human guinea pigs on whom to try out his ideas. In an interview last week, he remained unshakably convinced that he had invented an all-purpose cure for AIDS, cancer, and other diseases. So far as Sultan was concerned, the treatment was, quote, "successful," end quote. When I pointed out that all the AIDS patients and most of the cancer patients he had experimented on were now dead, he claimed, quote, "that is not how you judge a protocol." And further along in the article, my lord, it states, early in 1988, Sultan and Sharp were warned by one of Britain's foremost AIDS specialists that their experiments, if they had any effect at all, were more likely to harm AIDS patients than help them. Last spring, Sharp started treating 3 AIDS patients, including Susie Brown. Within 6 months, all 3 were dead. Their relatives and friends have been asked for more than £20,000 for the experiments, money they now want back. And the article continues, my lord, with the heading, "Our Secret Visits to Dr. Sharp." A 4th AIDS patient went to consult Dr. Sharp for treatment at London Bridge Hospital just 3 weeks ago. The patient, Harry Wilson, told Dr. Sharp that he had been diagnosed with AIDS early in 1988 and was desperate for anything that might save his life. Before he had even seen Sharp, Wilson was told at Browning's clinic that the treatment had made six AIDS patients, quote, alive and well and better, end quote, and that their method had successfully, quote, got rid, end quote, of AIDS. A friend who accompanied him, Duncan Sinclair, was then asked to pay £10,160 for, quote, a cure, end quote. But Harry Wilson didn't have AIDS. In fact, Wilson is clinically well, does not suffer from any disease, and is not infected with HIV. Wilson's friend, Duncan Sinclair, was me, Duncan Campbell, the investigative journalist. Strapped to my leg was a radio transmitter connected to a concealed microphone. As we went in to Browning's clinic and then London Bridge Hospital, an unmarked BBC recording van drew up nearby, staffed by members of the BBC watchdog programme. My undercover visit to Browning's clinic and the London Bridge Hospital had been motivated by extremely disturbing reports I had received 3 months ago from friends of Susie's. They were concerned that she and her family had been exploited. Like Susie Brown, all the patients whom Sharp offered to treat faced serious, painful and terminal illness. Like Susie, they were dying people, often only too ready to clutch at any straw that might lengthen their lives. They, as well as their friends, relatives and carers, are usually at the end of their tethers and may be acutely vulnerable to exploitation. So, in conjunction with Watchdog, we decided jointly to investigate exactly how Sharp and his colleagues dealt with patients. We needed to obtain incontrovertible evidence of what patients were told and how they were treated. I rang London Bridge Hospital at the beginning of March and asked about treatment for AIDS. I did not identify myself as a journalist. I was told to contact Dr. Sharp. Before we met Dr. Sharp, we were told that we first had to be interviewed by Philip Barker, the managing director of Browning's. He told us that, quote, we have treated patients with AIDS very effectively. Those who have had the treatment are in no danger of dying, end quote. Barker then added, quote, it's terribly important you are treated as soon as possible. Then you should be feeling a lot better, end quote. The treatment, he claimed, was, quote, absolutely harmless. These statements were quite inaccurate. Of three AIDS patients treated by Sharp, three were dead. And Sharp's treatment was riddled with actual and potential hazards to patients. Money was essential, quote, if you couldn't afford it, we wouldn't do it, end quote, he advised us. As Sinclair, I told Barker that I was willing to mortgage my house to pay for Wilson to be cured. Barker asked me to pay £5,000 to Browning's, quote, straight away, end quote. Next, we saw Dr. Sharp himself. He wasn't very interested in his patient's welfare. The interview took place in a small ward office, not a consulting room. Sharp spent less than 6 minutes asking about Wilson's medical history and neither asked for nor wrote notes. Without medically examining or even touching Wilson, Sharp prescribed him a £10,000 course of immunotherapy treatment starting the very next morning. He offered him hope, quote, we're looking for indefinite survival, end quote. Without asking for the name of his doctor, Sharp told him immediately to stop taking anti-AIDS drugs. It is professional misconduct and may be very dangerous for one doctor to interfere in this way with treatment being given to a patient under the care of another doctor without consulting the other doctor first. Wilson described symptoms which any novice AIDS doctor would have diagnosed immediately as an imminent attack of lethal pneumonia. Sharp didn't even have a stethoscope. Wilson told Sharp that Kaposi's sarcoma cancer has just been found in his mouth. Sharp didn't look in Wilson's mouth, yet told him that the treatment, quote, will have an effect, end quote, on the sarcoma. There was no cancer. Dr. Sharp described his treatment as posing, quote, absolutely no danger, end quote, to Wilson. Leading immunologists and AIDS doctors say the opposite is true. Harm was theoretically likely. Sharp was confused about how many patients he had and whether they were alive or well. Quote, we've had successful responses in 5 out of 6 AIDS patients, end quote, Sharp told us. Then he admitted that 2 patients were dead. The time we spent with Sharp and Barker spanned barely half an hour. No consent forms were sought, yet Sharp told Wilson to start treatment, quote, the sooner the better, end quote. Harry Wilson's visit was the second of two test consultations with Sharp. In the first case, Peter Baker, a man who suffers from age-related complex, was referred to Sharp for consultation on the 23rd of January. During the consultation, Sharp didn't carry out any medical examination or take any notes. He didn't propose to contact the doctors at St Mary's Hospital where Peter was being given real treatment. Peter and his mother were told by Barker that Sharp's treatment would keep him alive, quote, for 10 to 15 years, end quote. Just 1 week later, Browning's clinic sent Peter an invoice for £5,088, which he was asked to pay before treatment began. Any claim that Peter might hope to live for 10 to 15 years is at present quite ludicrous, even with the best of proven AIDS treatments. Peter has been on AZT for 2 years, has suffered many illnesses and lost a great deal of weight, and now needs blood transfusions just to stay alive and active. Peter told me last week that he probably has less than 3 years left to live and fears he will be dead long before his 40th birthday. The claims made to him by Sharp and Barker he found laughable. Quote, they're a bunch of greedy and unscrupulous charlatans, he said. Experienced doctors throughout Britain told of such claims have been uniformly horrified. Quote, the issue is that people who are incredibly vulnerable are being taken for a ride. That is offensive, said Professor Michael Adler, who heads the Middlesex Hospital AIDS team. Quote, the medical profession has a responsibility not to trade in and capitalise on people's anxiety and vulnerability when they have a fatal disease. And Duncan Campbell goes on to say that he's been contacted by somebody who's been treated by Dr. Sharp, where he states in his article, this Monday, 23-year-old Johnny Matthews rang me to say that he had been one of the two guinea pigs. He was angry that after months in which Sharp had taken no interest in his welfare, he was suddenly contacted by Philip Barker. Barker wanted to find out if he had spoken to the BBC and, quote, was he well? No, he wasn't. He had suffered several side effects from the treatment. He had not gained weight or seen the disappearance of thrush in his mouth, as Sharp and Sultan had claimed in their rejected scientific papers. In the months since Sharp had experimented on him, he had got worse. He had pneumonia and other progressive effects of HIV disease. Joanna Green, 27, a young Home County's wife, 25-year-old Susie Brown, and Andrew White, 28, a film producer living in London, were all AIDS patients at the same West London hospital. They were all very ill and knew that they would die before they were 30. A fourth patient, an American man infected with HIV, flew over from Los Angeles. Sharp relieved them all of large sums of money. Susie's parents were asked for £6,000. Andrew's friends paid at least £4,000 for him to be treated. A major AIDS charity threw in another £2,500 for Susie. Until we intervened last week, friends of all three patients were being pursued for yet more money by Browning's clinic and the London Bridge Hospital. Joanna's husband, Mike, who himself became HIV positive and now faces the prospect of AIDS, received demands from Browning's for over £10,000. It was money he could only have paid by selling the house where he lives. And further down in the article, my Lord Duncan Campbell goes on to share, other attempts by Sharp to win genuine scientific respectability have been completely rebuffed. In January 1988, he tried to publish reports of his work in Nature and the British Medical Journal. His paper was sent back. In February 1988, he approached St Mary's Hospital in search of new patients. He was sent packing. Undeterred, in June, he submitted an application to the Medical Research Council asking for a grant of £96,000 to experiment on six more patients. The half-long page application was turned down out of hand by the MRC, some of whose committee members regarded it as almost a sick joke. Quote, it was an insult to an application form, end quote. Worse was to come. At a meeting of the British Society of Immunology in Kensington Town Hall on the 11th of November 1988, senior doctors watched in astonishment as Jabbar Sultan, publicly described his experiments on leukemia, cancer, and AIDS sufferers, one top consultant said, quote, "I've never seen anything so appalling in my life. It was Mickey Mouse stuff. It was unethical." Dr. Angus Dalgleish, a leading AIDS researcher at Northwick Park Hospital, told us, quote, "It was the most scientifically unfounded presentation I'd ever heard." In a synopsis of Sultan's talk at the BSI, he and Sharp claimed to have found, quote, "a significant lasting clinical improvement in their free AIDS patients." The truth, as Sultan knew, was different. Two of the patients had died soon after starting treatment. As he spoke, he knew that the third patient, Susie Brown, lay on her deathbed just half a mile away. Susie died 6 days later. And my lord, the article continues and goes on. It's a fascinating read if anybody is interested in reading all 6 pages. The link is in the Extra Tea blog. It will take you directly to Duncan Campbell's website where he has so generously uploaded this article. Also, my lord, if I may, I found some interesting articles on Dr. Sharp from 1987.
Mr. Hampson, is it relevant to the matter at hand?
Not entirely to this matter, my lord. I just feel they may highlight Dr. Sharp's professional medical background as a haematologist, given some of the headlines thus far may allude that Dr. Sharp was, to quote the word, bogus in regards to his alleged AIDS cure.
Very well. You may proceed.
Thank you, my lord. On the 5th of February 1987, the Gloucester News cited Dr. Sharp in an article regarding the then controversial opening of the Lister Arthur Medical Centre, where the newspaper stated it was, quote, "the first private blood bank in Europe." And it was deemed to be controversial as it was a private blood bank where individuals in fear of AIDS could store their HIV-negative blood in the event they ever needed it. And given the substantial charges for storing the blood, the NHS and other authorities felt it was making money off the back of the fear of AIDS. Dr. Sharp is cited as the centre's, quote, medical director. However, a little over 2 months later, on the 8th of April 1987, Dr. Sharp is mentioned in an article in the Western Daily Press where they state, "Harley Street haematologist Dr. James Sharp resigned as the centre's medical director recently because of publicity about it." And as I mentioned a moment ago, there was strong opposition to the centre, hence the negative press that it seemingly attracted. And my lord, the only other insight into Dr. Sharp's earlier career is back in 1989 and the Daily Post, who reported on the 24th of November 1989, Dr. Sharp was appointed senior lecturer and consultant in haematology at King's College Hospital, London, in 1975. In 1984, he left the hospital apparently to go into private practice. Back to the hearing, my lord, the Independent wrote an article titled "Clinic Gave Untested Treatment to AIDS Victims." Then on Saturday the 25th of November 1989, the Independent wrote an article titled "Clinic Gave Untested Treatment to AIDS Victims," where they state, "A man with no medical qualifications was allowed to treat with an untested cure a woman who was dying of AIDS, it was alleged yesterday. Jabbar Sultan gave adoptive immunotherapy treatment to the woman who went to a private clinic in London's West End, it was claimed. Mr. Sultan, referred to as Dr. Sultan at the clinic, was credited as being the inventor of the treatment when Dr. James Sharp resigned as director. But the General Medical Council Disciplinary Committee was told yesterday that Mr. Sultan was not a qualified doctor. Dr. Sharp, who ran the clinic for 2 years, is accused of serious professional misconduct and is alleged to have continued to use the therapy a year after being warned against it. Dr. Anthony Pinching, a senior lecturer in clinical immunology, told Dr. Sharp that there was no sound scientific basis for believing the therapy was helping the patient. The hearing was told the treatment involved treating white blood cells from either the patient or a donor, then re-injecting them into the patient. Dr. Sharp is said to have insufficient training and knowledge to deal with patients, not to have disclosed his financial interest in the clinic, and to have charged patients for treatment and offered the therapy without conducting proper and approved clinical trials. Henry Cassidy, a nurse who posed as an AIDS sufferer as part of a BBC watchdog investigation, told the hearing the doctor did not examine him during a meeting when he said he could have the treatment. A letter from the clinic said that Dr. Jabbar Sultan was the treatment's inventor, he added. The mother of the woman who died said she consulted Dr. Sharp in 1988 and treatment took place at the London Bridge Hospital in May. Her daughter, who was diagnosed as having developed AIDS in 1986, died last November. The hearing continues on Monday. Jabbar Sultan, mentioned in this article, was not brought before the GMC, the General Medical Council, because, as we heard in the article, he wasn't a doctor, therefore not under their jurisdiction. But we'll hear a little more about him later. Back to the hearing, my lord, which continues, and on the 28th of November 1989, the Daily Post report in their newspaper the testimony given at the hearing by a highly regarded HIV/AIDS doctor, where they quote him telling the hearing, "A doctor who approached an AIDS specialist seeking to use the specialist patients for an experimental treatment was told it could actually make their condition worse. Dr. Anthony Pinching, senior lecturer in clinical immunology at St. Mary's, who has treated hundreds of patients who have full-blown AIDS or are HIV positive, described the data put forward by Dr. James Sharp in support of his treatment as, quote, very dubious, vague, poor, and inconsistent. Dr. Pinching recommended further tests in laboratories and on animals to ensure that, if the experiments proceeded to tests on humans, his concerns would have been checked out. Dr. Pinching concluded, I was unimpressed.
Mr. Hampson, did the individual enter a plea or at the very least respond to the allegations before them?
My lord, all we can glean from the press reports is that Dr. James Sharp denied the allegations before him. And as a result of the work of Duncan Campbell, the investigative journalist who wrote for the New Statesman and Society, along with his research in conjunction with BBC's Watchdog programme, wrote a piece in The New Scientist on the 29th of April 1989, where he stated, the clinic which Sharp established sacked him both as manager and as a doctor earlier this year. A group of senior doctors are reporting him to the General Medical Council for serious professional misconduct.
A sad and most interesting set of circumstances. How did they rule in this matter?
Well, my lord, the General Medical Council concluded the hearing by making a ruling on the 30th of November 1989. The newspapers closely following the hearing reported the ruling the very next day, such as the Daily Post, who ran the headline, Doctor Misled AIDS Sufferers, where they go on to state, a doctor who charged patients £700 for an experimental AIDS treatment was ordered to be struck off yesterday after being found guilty of serious professional misconduct. Dr. James Sharp, 48, was told he had, quote, sought to take advantage of particularly vulnerable patients and their relatives. Dr. Sharp, who ran a private clinic in London's West End for 2 years, was found guilty on 37 out of 43 counts of misconduct. A six-day hearing was told he, 1. Misled patients by promising a new AIDS treatment which could enable them to, quote, live indefinitely, 2. Failed to tell clients their treatment fees were going to his own company, 3. Claimed the treatment, adoptive immunotherapy, had proved successful in other cases when, 3 people had in fact died. Counsel for the General Medical Council, Timothy Langdale, said it was, quote, astonishing, end quote, that the doctor had failed to tell anyone about this last, quote, truthful and very significant fact. Dr. Sharp's counsel, Bernard Hargrove, claimed patients had been made aware that the treatment was not guaranteed to work. However, he admitted that Dr. Sharp had been, quote, over-enthusiastic. End quote. After the hearing, Dr. Sharp said he might appeal against the decision. And on that note, there is no record that I could find that indicated that Dr. Sharp decided to appeal the decision. However, fast forward 7 years where, on the 3rd of October 1996, the Independent newspaper run the headline, BBC counts cost of AIDS libel victory, and the article states, a 7-year legal battle over a television documentary into an alleged AIDS cure clinic ended in victory for the BBC yesterday, but leaves the corporation with a legal bill estimated at £800,000. The last of 3 victims of the joint Watchdog and New Statesman investigation, which led to a doctor being struck off for professional misconduct, abandoned his action for libel.
The BBC One Watchdog.
Hello and welcome once again to Watchdog. In this week's programme, the doctor who cruelly misled AIDS victims. After we expose him, he's struck off.
Senior BBC management are understood to be angry that such huge amounts of licence payers' money had to be spent defending legal actions that some observers saw as unwinnable. After the end of yesterday's High Court action, a BBC spokesman said it was regrettable they had to defend such an expensive case. The hearing plaintiff, Jabbar Sultan, an Iraqi who was highlighted by the 1989 investigation as the scientist, said to be qualified as a veterinary surgeon who ran the Adoptive Immunotherapy Unit at London Bridge Hospital. The New Statesman article described the treatment as worthless. Mr. Sultan, 52, issued writs against both media organisations and represented himself when the case came before the High Court earlier this year. Before the summer recess, Mr. Justice Alliot told Mr. Sultan, quote, "I see no prospects of you winning this case," end quote. The judge also said the trial was, quote, "costing the licence payers of the BBC a great deal of money," end quote. When the hearing resumed yesterday, Mr. Sultan dropped his actions. He was not asked to pay costs and said afterwards that he had no money left after a, quote, "7-year, end quote, battle. It was an, quote, "unsatisfactory end," he said. In July, Dr. James Sharp, who ran the private clinic, abandoned his actions for malicious falsehood against the BBC and the New Statesman. 7 days into a High Court hearing, he had earlier been granted legal aid, later suspended on the advice of one of his own barristers. Dr. Sharp was struck off by the General Medical Council in November 1989, who said he had, quote, "held out false hopes as to the outcome of treatment of an experimental nature for HIV-associated conditions." The third case involving the managing director of the clinic, Philip Barker, who was suing for malicious falsehood, was struck out by Mr. Justice Alliot on the 26th of June after the judge said there was not a, quote, "scintilla of evidence of malice." Duncan Campbell, the journalist who wrote the New Statesman article, said the defendants had, quote, "abused the legal system as a means of punishing those who expose them without winning a single part of their case," end quote. The BBC's costs are estimated at between £600,000 and £800,000, with the New Statesman at a five-figure sum. And it wasn't just the BBC that these three gentlemen were trying to make claims again, because in addition, on the 12th of October 1996, the British Medical Journal wrote in their own publication, quote, "The BMJ and the New Statesman took a back seat to the BBC in the litigation, but the BMJ's costs totaled £107,000. And if anybody is wondering what happened to Dr. James Sharp after, well, he was back in the newspapers as recently as 2018, although it was his son making the headlines. On the 4th of December 2018, London's Evening Standard ran the headline, "Son spent over £100,000 of sick father's savings on Netflix and meals out." And the article reads, "A health entrepreneur helped himself to more than £100,000 from his ailing father's savings to pay his Netflix bill and buy meals out," a court heard. Max Sharp, 48, was given control of Dr. James Caveney Sharp's finances after he became ill in 2017. Sharp allegedly took at least £100,000 out of his father's account over 7.5 years. Andrew Johnson, prosecuting, told in a London Crown Court, "Sharp treated the bank account, quote, as if it was his own," end quote. "Spending on meals out, online services including Netflix and paying off his credit card bills." When questioned by police, Sharp said he knew it was, quote, "wrong," end quote, and claimed he had used the money when he ran into financial difficulties. Max Sharp runs the family health business based in Harley Street, London. His father, now 80, was a consultant in London hospitals who fell into alcoholism. He is in a care home and jurors were told he does not have long to live. The court heard Sharp claimed his father, if he was capable of deciding, quote, "would have been more than willing to assist him," end quote, out of his financial woes. Quote, "He rationalised that whatever was taken would have been deducted from whatever he was left when his father died and his assets fell to be divided between him and his brothers," added Mr. Johnson. Sharp, from Brixton, denies fraud. And the Daily Mail, who also reported on the court case, state, a health club owner accused of helping himself to more than £100,000 from his frail father's savings when put in charge of the seriously ill man's finances has denied fraud. My lord, these articles repeatedly refer to Dr. Sharp as frail, and while I wouldn't condone such behaviour, I find it hard to garner any sympathy for Dr. Sharp, who, let's not forget, was found guilty and removed from the medical register. He didn't care one bit for those vulnerable people with HIV and AIDS-related conditions when he pushed his bogus cure and charged them thousands of pounds for the privilege, not only stealing their money, but their hope of whatever future they had left. I couldn't find any additional reports on what happened to his son, Mr. Sharp. However, I did establish that Dr. James Sharp died within days of that Evening Standard article of the 4th of December 2018.
Mr. Hampson, I believe you have another series of articles you wish to bring before the listeners?
Yes, my lord. That's the bizarre and disturbing actions of 21-year-old Mark Lloyd Flynn. One of, if not the first newspapers to report this story, was the Acton Gazette on the 24th of July 1987, who ran the headline, Man Faces Trial for AIDS Attack, with the strapline, Hospital Ban is Condition of Bail. In the article, the magistrate, Sir Brian Roberts, ruled the case should be put before the Crown Court and not the magistrate. Given reporting restrictions laid down by the court, it was just under 3 weeks later when local and national newspapers began to report the story, having seen some of those reporting restrictions lifted. Thus, on the 13th of August 1987, the Guardian newspaper ran the headline, Court Bans Man from Hospitals. And the article states, a man accused of masquerading as a doctor and allegedly assaulting AIDS patients in a ward in London was yesterday banned from every hospital in the country. Mark Lloyd Flynn, aged 20, a former medical research technician, was remanded until August 26 at Horsebury Road Magistrates Court for committal proceedings. The ban was a condition of bail. The magistrate, Sir Brian Roberts, told him, quote, the condition prohibits you from entering any hospital save for receiving emergency treatment, end quote. Lloyd Flynn of Balbury Road, North Kensington, is charged under the 1983 Medical Act with willfully and falsely pretending to be a doctor at the Thomas Macaulay Ward of St Stephen's Hospital in Fulham between April the 14th and 28th this year. He is further charged with assaulting two AIDS patients in the ward, causing them actual bodily harm on April the 19th and 25th. Reporting restrictions were not lifted. And in regard to the two AIDS patients he is accused of assaulting, the Independent newspaper on the same day gave a little more insight into these patients, where they reported, to protect their identities, the alleged victims were referred to by their Christian names only, Graham and Bill. Following his arrest, Mr. Lloyd of Yorkley House, Balbury Road, North Kensington, resigned from his research job at the Central Middlesex Hospital in London. Last month, the prosecution dropped other assault charges against him because the two alleged victims were dying from AIDS and were felt to be too weak to act as prosecution witnesses in court. The men were allegedly examined by Mr. Lloyd Flynn at St. Stephen's Hospital. And, my lord, the same principle applied with regard to these two men, where they were referred to in court by their actual Christian names, and they were Trevor and Stephen. Mark Lloyd Flynn is committed for trial at Suffolk Crown Court in London on the 26th of August 1987, and it makes the newspapers the following day, where they share the accounts we have just heard. Lloyd Flynn appeared before Judge William Clarkson QC at Suffolk Crown Court on the 6th of May 1988. The Guardian newspaper reported the trial and sentencing the following day, where they ran the headline, Bogus Doctor Who Stalked AIDS Wards. And the article states, a bogus doctor who treated patients in the AIDS wards of three London hospitals was gulled for 18 months yesterday. Mark Lloyd Flynn, aged 21, a trainee medical researcher, was trying to cause them deliberate injury, Suffolk Crown Court was told. For 2 weeks, he stalked the wards of St Stephen's Hospital, Fulham, St Mary's Hospital, Paddington, and the Middlesex Hospital, Camden, convincing staff that he worked there, said Peter Clark, prosecuting. Quote, "If there had been stringent checks at these hospitals, these matters may never have happened. Lloyd Flynn diagnosed his own medications for aid victims against previous doctors' orders." Mr. Clark said, quote, "He was seeking to do deliberate injury to the people he was dealing with. He must have known perfectly well he was placing them in considerable danger. He was stalking the wards, seeking to do harm to people suffering from the AIDS epidemic." Lloyd Flynn wore a doctor's white coat and carried a stethoscope. Mr. Clark said, quote, "Nurses assumed he was a bona fide research doctor attached to an outside concern. He developed an obsession with medical matters, and that obsession seemed to center on treatment for sufferers of the HIV complaint."
Mr. Hampson, did the accused put forward a defense in these matters?
Well, my lord, yes, ish. As Mr. Kieran Coonan, defending, is quoted in the same article as stating to the court, he, Lloyd Flynn the defendant, became a fascinated observer into cases of this serious disease and is living in cloud cuckoo land with hopeless expectations of his own abilities. I guess, my lord, the defence is hoping for a lenient sentence by portraying their client as a bit of a daydreamer, a fantasist. However, my lord, the article continues. Lloyd Flynn of Yorkley House, North Kensington, admitted 3 charges of unlawful wounding and 2 charges of common assault in April last year. He once tried, unsuccessfully, 3 or 4 times to take a blood sample from a male patient while nurses watched, said Mr. Clark. The nurses put it down to nervousness and one of them took over while Lloyd Flynn left the ward. And to break away from this Guardian article, my lord, on the same day, the 7th of May 1988, the Newcastle Journal quoted Mr. Peter Clark, prosecuting, of another encounter Lloyd Flynn had with an AIDS patient where, that article states, in one incident, a tube carrying medicine directly to the heart of a terminally ill AIDS patient, described as fading fast, became blocked. It was an important and extremely difficult task to clear it, but Lloyd Flynn was eager to help. It was quite obvious he was very nervous, his hands were shaking, and the nurse had to take over. Back to that Guardian article, my lord, it continues. Mr. Clark said he gained the confidence of AIDS patients at St. Stephen's and took blood from one who was near death. He spoke as though he was a house doctor and, after only 2 days, took blood from an AIDS patient. The ward doctor was elsewhere. Quote, "He did not have the sense or courage to leave the ward or make it clear he shouldn't be there." End quote. Changing patients' antibiotics led to his downfall. Lloyd Flynn was arrested after a speedy investigation by doctors and police. He only visited St. Mary's Hospital once. A nurse told him he had no right to be there and Lloyd Flynn never returned. At the 2 other hospitals, he told dying patients that he had researched AIDS in San Francisco. Lloyd Flynn told police, quote, "I am doing research. It's absurd to think I'm a bogus doctor. I am qualified as an MMBS, a Bachelor of Medicine and Surgery, and can class myself as a doctor." Lloyd Flynn was fined £150 in 1986 for stealing prescription pads from a doctor's surgery to get tranquilizers, the court heard. And before the judge passed sentence, the Marylebone and Paddington Mercury reported that Mark Lloyd Flynn addressed the judge by stating, "I'm sorry for what happened and I'm very ashamed about it. It won't happen again."
A sad and most interesting set of circumstances. How did they rule in this matter?
Well, my lord, Judge William Clarkson's closing remarks upon the sentence imposed upon Mark Lloyd Flynn are reported in The Guardian as follows. Passing sentence, Judge William Clarkson, QC, told him, "You were interfering with seriously ill patients and had no business to even involve yourself. The public must be concerned to know it is possible for a person to pretend they are a doctor. I cannot possibly pass this extremely rare case over without a prison sentence." Mark Lloyd Flynn was then sentenced to 18 months imprisonment. In the days that followed his sentencing, the local and national press reported on the story. The Chelsea News on the 12th of May 1988, under the headline, Jail Sentence for Doctor Act, stated, Security on wards at St. Stephen's Hospital has been stepped up after a trainee medical technician posed as a doctor and took blood from desperately ill AIDS patients. Hospital spokesman Lynn Clements said this week that doctors now made, quote, enormous efforts, end quote, to warn staff of visits by research doctors and to introduce them to everyone on the wards. Nurses have been instructed to call security immediately if anyone unexpected arrives claiming to be a doctor or doing research, she added.
Mr. Hampson, did the party concerned submit an appeal?
Yes, my lord. Because 3 months after being sentenced, and subsequently those defending Lloyd Flynn submitting an appeal, hear the outcome which is reported on the front page of the Chelsea News on the 25th of August 1988, with the headline, Doctor's Term Cut, where they report, a laboratory technician who tricked staff at Chelsea's St. Stephen's Hospital into letting him treat patients dying of AIDS has succeeded in having his 18-month prison sentence cut. Three Court of Appeal judges agreed that the sentence imposed on Mark Lloyd Flynn, 21 of Balbury Road, North Kensington, was too long and reduced it to 9 months. The judge, who described Lloyd Flynn as immature, said although there had been a risk of serious injury, none had occurred. And he added that it was inevitable that AIDS sufferers would have been distressed to learn they had been treated by an unqualified person. But, he said, the sentence passed at Suffolk Crown Court in May after Lloyd Flynn admitted wounding and common assault was too much, bearing in mind his age and guilty plea. And given Mark Lloyd's age at the time, there's no reason why he isn't still alive today, but I was unable to find any trace of Mark Lloyd Flynn, even from birth, before and after his arrest and sentencing. I found leads for a Mark Lloyd, but I have also found leads for a Mark Flynn. So, which is which? If either one is the Mark Lloyd Flynn. My lord, he seems merely to have vanished.
Mr. Hampson presented a series of poignant cases today, illustrating the complex interplay between victimhood and culpability. While it is crucial to acknowledge the moral and legal violations that have occurred, we must also consider the profound impact of an HIV or AIDS diagnosis. Each case serves as a stark reminder that beneath the offences, there existed a life, one that preceded the incidents we have just heard. And for many, these lives are now but memories, tragically cut short. In reflecting on these stories, we are compelled to recognize the humanity of those involved and the heavy burdens they carried, reinforcing the importance of empathy in our discussions of justice and morality. This podcast is adjourned until next week.
Court rise!
You can check out and read all the newspaper articles mentioned in this episode, along with extra snippets of information, on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. Until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at The Lost Boys of Soho.